All right, so we've got a wild one today. We're talking about a case. It starts with like pretty normal fast food robbery, you know, back in 1981.
Yeah, your typical McDonald's just trying to get through the day.
Right. Happens in Ohio. And okay, whatever. Robberies happen, right? But then it gets really crazy.
Things take a turn.
Yeah, because it ends up with a police officer murdered. Not even in Ohio, though. This is across state lines in West Virginia. But get this. The guy who gets convicted for the murder. He didn't even pull the trigger. How is that even possible?
That's what we're going to break down. This case, State v. Male from 1987, it really digs into like the nitty-gritty of who's actually responsible when a crime goes completely sideways. And specifically, there's this thing called the felony murder rule.
So for everyone listening, this case is like a masterclass in how the legal world connects the dots, how they interpret a whole series of events. It's not always just about, you know, you did the crime, you did the time. Sometimes it goes way beyond that.
Right. It's about expanding that scope of liability and figuring out, legally speaking, where does the buck stop? I mean, think about it. It raises some huge questions about like fairness and justice. You know, when someone's held responsible for a death they didn't directly cause, we'll see how this case tackles that.
Totally. So, to get into this, we've got the actual State v. Male court decision itself. We're going deep on this one, folks. The facts, the arguments, everything. Our goal here is simple. Understand Male, understand this felony murder thing and this whole continuous transaction idea. And hey, we'll also see just how much power trial courts have in West Virginia. But first, set the stage for us. What actually went down in this whole crazy story?
Okay, rewind to December 14th, 1981, Chesapeake, Ohio. We've got Wilbert Male and his buddy Bobby Stacy. They decide to rob a McDonald's armed robbery.
Classic.
And, you know, they make off with the usual cash, whatever. But here's the thing, they also swipe some car keys from an employee.
Ah, foreshadowing. I see where this is going.
Yep, that stolen car becomes their getaway vehicle. Important detail. Now, fast forward about 30 minutes, we're hopping over the state border to Huntington, West Virginia.
New state, new problems. What happens?
So in Huntington, there's a break-in at a gas station. Officer Harmon, he shows up to respond to the call, you know, doing his job. And then, well, during this whole encounter, he's tragically killed.
Man, that's heavy. So at this point, it's a murder investigation full on. What do they have to go on? What clues were they working with?
Now they find that stolen car, the one from McDonald's, ditched in Huntington.
Yeah.
And inside, bingo, stuff from the robbery, a ski mask, and chillingly, Officer Harmon's own gun.
Okay, so right away you're thinking that's got to be pretty damning evidence. But it didn't stop there, did it?
Oh no, this is where forensics comes in big time. They dust for fingerprints, and guess who's they find all over the steering wheel of that abandoned car? Male. So now he's directly tied to the scene.
Busted. And then, to top it off, they did hair analysis right on a couple of ski masks.
Right, two masks. One they found inside the car, another near it, and the hair matches both Male and Stacy. I mean, talk about incriminating.
Wow. So the physical evidence is stacking up. But what about witnesses? Did anyone actually see what happened?
There was this woman, Kathy Pearson. She knew Stacy, and she testifies that on the night of the murder, Stacy told her he had to go meet Jackie and pick him up and go to the hills and take care of business. Turned out Jackie was Male's nickname. So now Male's connected to Stacy and his, you know, less than innocent plans for that night. Of course, Male's got to try and defend himself.
Yeah, he tries to pull an alibi, get some witnesses to say, oh, he was with us, couldn't have been at the murder. But then the prosecution pulls out a photograph.
Oh, this is the good part.
Right, a photo of Male taken that very same day. And his hair, his facial hair, everything completely contradicts what his own alibi witnesses were saying.
Talk about a major backfire. I mean, his whole defense just went up in smoke.
Yeah, I can't imagine what his lawyer was thinking at that point. But so the prosecution's building this case, and their big argument, it all comes down to this idea of a single continuous crime spree. How did they make that argument?
They're saying, look, forget about separate incidents. This was all one thing. The McDonald's robbery in Ohio, the break-in in West Virginia, the murder, all connected, all part of the same criminal act. And the key here, Male and Stacy never reached a place of safety. They were always in the middle of it, still fleeing from that first robbery.
So, how does that continuous transaction idea trigger this felony murder rule? Like, what even is that rule?
Well, the court in Male, they lay it out pretty clear. Three main parts. First, you got to have an enumerated felony, basically, or really serious crime, robbery, burglary, arson, stuff like that. In this case, that McDonald's robbery, that's our felony. Second, the defendant has to be involved in that felony. And for Male, well, his fingerprints on the getaway car, pretty solid evidence of his participation. And lastly, the victim's death, it has to directly result from injuries during that felony.
Okay, so that last part, that connection between the robbery and the officer's death, that's where continuous transaction gets really important, right?
Exactly. The court's saying, even though there's time and distance between the Ohio robbery and the West Virginia murder, legally speaking, that robbery wasn't over. Why? Because Male and Stacy hadn't gotten away clean. They hadn't split the loot, hadn't finished their criminal business. So their escape, everything they did afterwards, it was all part of that same criminal act, one continuous transaction. And the court even says, I'm quoting here, whether the robbers were conducting their escape or were moving on to another crime, their activities were a part of one continuous transaction.
So are you saying, even if they finished the robbery, like got the money and all that, if they're still escaping, that felony murder rule could still apply?
That's what the court's suggesting. The act of escaping, it's all tied into that original crime. It's not over till it's over, basically. And this really shows the difference between felony murder and, say, intentional murder. For intentional murder, you got to prove intent, right? That the person meant to kill. But with felony murder, that intent doesn't matter. The death happened during a dangerous felony or right after, that's enough. And in Male's case, the court's definition of right after, well, it was pretty broad.
So I'm sure Male's lawyers had a lot to say about all this.
Yeah.
What were some of their big arguments when they appealed?
Oh, they definitely fought back. One argument was about jury selection, the voir dire process. They said the court messed up by questioning potential jurors as a group, not one by one.
Interesting. So what did the appeals court say about that?
They basically backed up the trial court, said individual questioning is only necessary if there's, you know, clear signs of bias. In this case, they didn't see it. And they really stressed that trial courts have a lot of leeway in running jury selection. To overturn that, they'd need to see a clear abuse of that power, and they didn't think it happened here.
Okay, so the jury selection thing, that didn't fly. What else did they try?
Well, remember, Male had a criminal record. His lawyers argued that those past convictions shouldn't have been allowed as evidence.
Makes sense why bring up old stuff.
Right. But the appeals court pointed to the law back then, in 1982, when the trial happened. And back then, it was okay to use past convictions in certain situations. The age of those convictions, that could affect how much weight the jury gave them, but it didn't make them automatically inadmissible.
So the past convictions stayed in. What about all those crime scene photos? Weren't those kind of gruesome?
Yeah, the defense tried to argue that those photos would, you know, unfairly sway the jury, too prejudicial. But the appeals court wasn't buying it. They said, yeah, there's blood stains, but you don't actually see the body. Not overly gruesome. And more importantly, those photos, they helped prove key facts about the crime scene. Legally speaking, that's called probative value. There's this thing called Rule 403. It's basically a balancing act. Does the evidence help prove something important? Or is it just there to make the jury hate the defendant? The court decided the photos were more helpful than harmful, so they stayed in.
Sounds like the appeals court kept siding with the trial judge, huh?
Pretty much. And that's not unusual. Appellate courts, they tend to give a lot of deference to the trial judge's decisions. Why? Because the trial judge is there in the room, seeing everything firsthand, hearing the witnesses, feeling the vibe. So unless the trial judge makes a really obvious mistake that really hurts the defendant's chances, the appeals court usually won't interfere.
Makes sense. So for our listeners who are just starting to wrap their heads around all this, what's the big takeaway from State v. Male?
I'd say the main point is felony murder, it can apply even when there's a good check of time and distance between the original felony and the death. That continuous transaction idea, that's the glue that holds it all together. If the criminals haven't reached a safe haven, if it's all part of the same chain reaction starting from that felony, then the link is still there.
So if you're a defense attorney and you're dealing with a case like this, what's your move?
You attack that continuous transaction, argue that the felony was over, that they did reach safety, that what happened next was a whole separate thing. If you can break that chain, you might be able to beat the felony murder charge.
And for anyone out there who's thinking about, you know, becoming a prosecutor or maybe even a judge, what does this case tell you?
For prosecutors, it's all about building that rock solid case that proves that unbroken chain of events from felony to death. Mm-hmm. The evidence, the witnesses, it all has to connect those dots clearly. And for judges, well, Male shows just how much power they have in things like jury selection and admitting evidence. And it shows that those decisions, they carry a lot of weight, even on appeal.
There was also a lot of talk about different types of evidence, right? Like what's strong evidence and what isn't?
Yeah, the court specifically talked about circumstantial evidence, which is a big part of the prosecution's case against Mail. They made a point of saying, circumstantial evidence is not per se less reliable than direct evidence. It is merely a different class of evidence which has its special dangers and its special advantages. Basically, just because there's no eyewitness saying, I saw him do it, doesn't mean the evidence is weak. It just means you have to analyze it differently, connect the dots.
And remember that whole thing with the photograph, the one that wrecked Mail's alibi. That was pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, that photo was like a knockout punch. It totally contradicted what his alibi witnesses said, and it did it in a way that was impossible to deny. It shows how even something small can completely change the game, especially when it comes to discrediting someone's story.
Okay, so bottom line, the State v. Mail decision, it upheld Mail's conviction for felony murder. The court basically said the robbery and the murder, same continuous act. And they agreed with pretty much everything the trial judge did.
Yep. And this case, it's still super relevant today, especially for understanding how broad that felony murder rule can be. It shows that courts sometimes take a very wide view of responsibility, even when someone didn't directly cause the death. And it highlights how much power those trial judges really have.
It definitely makes you think, if someone could be convicted of murder, even if they weren't the one who pulled the trigger, where do we draw the line? How far can this continuous transaction idea go? What about fairness? What about justice? Those are some big questions to ponder, and they go way beyond just this one case.
Absolutely. And if you're interested in learning more, I'd say look into how felony murder works in your own state. See what the laws are, see what the arguments are, both for and against it. It's a huge topic, and it affects real people in real ways.
Yeah, definitely worth digging into. All right, folks, that's our deep dive for today. We'll see you next time.